Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The British national dish, fish and chips,
right,
actually has Arab roots. Obviously not the chips.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome back to another archaeogastronomical adventure. Today is part two of our interview with Professor Newman, so sit tight and enjoy the latest episode of the Delicious Legacy, all about the medieval Arab cuisine. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of... Obviously, we have lots of recipes from that era, as you say. But what are the notable culinary inventions and kitchen inventions at the time? What's something that is notable that we can say, wow, that's the first time or one of the first times that we've heard about? What's the inventions in the area?
Well, it depends how far back you go. Well, I guess one of the things that springs to mind is the cooking method. And so the fact that they had different types of ovens, that's perhaps something that's a little bit unusual. Although if you think about it, once again, we also have different types of ovens. The difference is that they are put in one oven, and we use technology to change the settings, if you will. And so the two ovens they had still exist today, and they go back to Mesopotamian times. The first one is the famous tanur.
Yeah.
Which today is known as a tandoor, because obviously it's now associated with India, but it is profoundly a Near Eastern thing. And the tanoor is essentially a clay oven. It's a clay oven which is shaped like a beehive. You can still see them today. The average one would be about a meter high, and it has a hole at the top and a hole at the bottom. And so a fire is kindled at the bottom. And then what the tanur is most associated with, of course, is bread.
Yeah.
And so let us imagine that we are in the period and we are the cooks and we have to bake some bread. So we would start with our dough. So very simple, of course, you know, water, flour, salt. And we would then shape it into round loaves, unleavened, so there's no yeast or anything. And then once the oven has reached its temperature, which would be relatively quickly actually, we would then stick those loaves, those flat loaves, circular loaves, along the walls of the tanur.
Yeah.
And so it's both heat and convection that then bakes the bread. When it's ready, you take it out. Tanur was a very interesting and is a very interesting invention because it was really multi-purpose. So, you know, bread on the one hand, which is how it's still used today, of course. And then also they would heat up things. And so there were a number of possibilities. You could put a pot on top and so use it like that. But also it was used to stew very slowly certain dishes. So imagine we're still the chefs. We finished our baking. And so the oven is still hot, but it's not hot enough for the baking. So we're not kindling the fire.
Yeah.
But we put a few of these oven dishes, which are known as tanuriyat, in reference to the tanur.
Yeah.
We put those in at the bottom and leave them probably overnight, and then they would be ready the following morning. So this really slow cooking of stews, and you can imagine the how the flavors would have all been intermingled in those dishes.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah, this slow cooking is the best, actually. And yeah, I think even nowadays, I mean, if we cook something really slow, the flavor improves the next day. So I think they were definitely masters of that method of cooking.
Yes, yes, indeed. And then the other oven was a brick oven, which is more like the oven that we can all imagine. So that one has the... just a flat surface and a covering, which was used also for bread, but for many other things as well. And so usually they would light a fire on one side of the oven. And so rather today we simply, you know, turn the oven down. They would actually simply move the pots around, move it closer or farther away from the fire, and thus regulate the temperature. One very interesting thing about the tanur, which is really a wonderful invention, is that even things like kebabs, they would make it in the tanur. Now, we can assume that the kebab is probably one of the earliest cooking methods of meat. You can imagine soldiers by the campfire, they've cut up some meat, they put it on their sword, and they kind of turn it over the open flame.
Yeah.
But actually, if you want to have good kebabs, that's not the best way, as we now know, of course, because, you know, as anybody knows who's been to people who don't barbecue properly, present company excluded, of course, you end up with scorched meat and a raw center. So they would actually use the tanur for cooking kebabs. So they would skewer the meat and then put the skewers inside the tanur, thus ensuring, of course, this all-round cooking of the meat.
Well, this is all brilliant and exciting and really fascinating. So what, from that era, basically, what cookbooks do we have? What kind of authors? Do you have any names, basically? Do you have any people who we know that their names and... that they did some recipes or some cookbooks for the kings, or, you know?
That's an excellent question. We have a total of 10 cookery books, and it was during my research for the Sultan's Feast that I identified a new cookbook, one that hadn't yet been discussed.
Brilliant.
Prior to that, it was 9. Now, actually... when it comes to authorship, things are not very clear. Firstly, before I go on to authorship, as I've already said, so the cookery books cover a period of half a millennium, so from the 10th to the 15th centuries. And we have sources from across the Muslim world. So from Muslim Spain, Al-Andalus, all the way to Iraq. The 13th century was a particularly fertile one. That's when most of the books, the largest proportion of cookery books that have come down to us.
Yeah.
So authorship. Well, there are indeed names that are mentioned. About half of them actually are anonymous, which is not that surprising if you think about it. Because they weren't considered high literature, and cookery books, of course, would also be used in, let's say, less than ideal circumstances for preservation. Just as today, we have recipe books in our kitchens. And, and of course, you know, that's not a good way to preserve them for posterity. Yeah. At the same time, of course, it's important to mention that it was a culture that set great store by gastronomic culture. And so we have, for instance, one cookery book where an Ottoman sultan commissioned a beautifully done copy. So it was considered very important. Some cookery books, for instance, were copied multiple times, so with several manuscript versions that exist. But so the names of the authors, when they're known, it's not even always sure what their involvement in the cookery book was. And we can start already with the one that is considered to be the oldest, which is attributed to a man called El-Warraq.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
Yes. And El-Warraq is essentially, it's his name is already interesting. El-Warraq essentially means the bookseller. we can immediately wonder whether he is the author or the compiler. I personally don't like to talk about authorship, but rather compilership. Because in many cases, the compilers also borrowed extensively from one another and from other sources. And so we find a number of overlaps. Who are these authors? Well, in addition to the ones that have been preserved, over 40 are known through references in the literature, but have, to date, not surfaced.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to say, but we can imagine that there must have been, you know, close to, well, over 50, 55, maybe 60 in total, if we add everything up. And if you look at the list of authors that is given in the sources, it's very interesting. You find rulers, several caliphs who apparently wrote a cookery book. There's physicians, there's geographers, there's poets. There's all manner of individuals that plied this craft of the cookery book.
Absolutely.
And so some of them refer to the fact that they tried certain dishes. Some of them say, well, in this book, you know, these are dishes that I've invented. But in most cases, one can imagine that there was a kind of pool of recipes that they drew from. And of course, the fact that we have this long period of time is very interesting because it allows us to get a snapshot of changing palates in the region. And what is striking, actually, is that some dishes disappear, but on the whole, the palate, so the tastes that people appreciated, on the whole, that is pretty stable. And what happens then? So it stops in the 15th century for various reasons. The main reason, of course, being that in the East, there is a new empire that's about to sweep everything away, the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
And also, this meant that the patrons of these cooks, the grand banquets and so on, the courts, the elite that provided these banquets and needed these fancy dishes, that situation, that landscape changed. So that's the first thing. The thing that's really interesting is that on the one hand, in contemporary Middle Eastern cooking, as you pointed out, you know, there are very few things that are the same. On the other hand, there are many things that a medieval diner would have recognized. So just two very brief examples. The thing that I enjoy most about the medieval Arab culinary tradition are the stews, the fruit stews and so on.
Yeah.
And those have virtually disappeared. I say virtually. There's very few countries where they have those kinds of stews.
Mm.
In Iran, however, they're still very, very popular. So if you like, Iranian cuisine is probably closer to the medieval Arab cuisine than Arab cuisine is today. That's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah.
The other side of the story is that there are many dishes that are still around. And for instance, I already mentioned the kebabs, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
That's still around. Particularly sweets, things like qatayef and zulabiya and kunafa and so on. They're still around. And so there's a core, if you will, that has endured. But of course, a truly interesting thing, that the holy grail in Arab food history, is to find out, because in between the 15th and 19th centuries, there are no cookery books. At least none have come to light. And right. So in the 19th century, the cookery books are written in Arabic. Once again, cookery books for the elite. But this elite, of course, is now westernized. Mm. And so you have dishes that the Egyptian ruler would have had in Paris when he visited. And of course, he wants to reproduce them when he receives his grand European guests. So it's a different kind of animal entirely.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course. In terms of stews, so the fruit stews, mm-hmm. do you have a recipe that is indicative of that kind of stew, like what meat and what fruit, what spices would?
Yeah, there are many. There's a pomegranate stew, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Pomegranate stew, which is a wonderful dish, which I mentioned the Persian or the Iranian connection.
Yeah.
In Iran, there's an Iranian dish called fasanjan.
Yeah.
Which is very close to the pomegranate stew.
It has chicken, I think, and pomegranate and walnuts.
Yes, exactly, exactly. It's also made with duck, the fasanjan.
Right.
But chicken, of course, as well. The other, so you have, they were great fans of things that we would consider sour and bitter. So there's lemon stews, for instance. Vinegar is also often used.
Mm.
And so this is clearly something that appealed to their palate. Although I have to say that when we say vinegar, I think it's important not to assume that it's the vinegar that we have in our pantry today.
Mm-hmm.
And so they used wine vinegar, but they also probably used other kinds of vinegar. And there's one cookery book that provides a little insight into that. It's one of the Andalusian cookery books, or rather by an Andalusian emigre who essentially moves after the Castilian forces conquered his home region. And he skips across the Straits of Gibraltar, goes into Morocco, and then eventually ends up in Tunis. And he has a number of very interesting vinegar recipes: mint vinegar, grape vinegar, lime vinegar. So possibly when they say vinegar, again, what I said earlier about the chefs knowing which vinegar to use, I think that they would have used different kinds of vinegar for different types of dishes because they were so sophisticated. It's such a sophisticated cuisine, you know, and the visual was so important. They would color the dishes. They would shape dishes into molds, into different shapes. So I think the use of even core ingredients, we have to be very careful that we don't oversimplify.
I see.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Today's episode is brought to you with the welcome support of Maltby & Creek, UK's leading Greek delicatessen, supplier and distributor of premium Greek produce. Be it wine, herbs, cheeses or olive oil, from all over the wild corners of Greece, and working directly with small artisan producers. If you want to try some amazing traditional meats from Greece, preserved meats, why don't you get some Vavourakis organic smoked tzigalino from Maltby & Creek? So this is preserved and smoked pork in olive oil, and they follow a traditional Cretan recipe for it, which is really old. And the meat is smoked using olive wood, and it's flavored with pepper and cumin. So this is kind of this is the kind of meat and the kind of preservation techniques that go a long, long way to the past. And it has some relation to our episode today. Or you can try the organic Cretan sausages with cumin and vinegar. Again, another old Cretan recipe with roots to the Byzantine Empire. Whatever you need, Maltby & Creek has you covered. You can shop online and have the exquisite goods delivered to your doorstep across the UK, or you can visit the shop at Arch 17 Apollo Business Park, Lucy Way, SE16 4ET, Bermondsey, London. Maltby & Creek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. And, of course, for all you dear listeners, Maltby & Creek has an amazing discount of 15% off your next purchase. So go online, go to the website and type maltbyandgreek.com/delicious and you get 15% discount at the checkout. Yeah, the other thing that I obviously I've read a lot about is about the pickles. So yeah. As you said, the sour and the vinegary element, like a lot of stuff to make you hungry, to tickle the appetites, and make you salivate, you ready to eat more. Actually, and I find a lot of the pickles quite interesting from the period as well. Yeah, one of the interesting things is we have this connection with fish and vinegar dishes, and that go from Mesopotamia to Spain, and then this fish vinegary dishes that travel all the way to New World, and then we have the dishes coming back from the New World to Europe, and it all goes back to medieval Mesopotamia, Arab cuisine, and so forth. And I think that's really amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, the connection you've just outlined, I mean, that of course brings to mind the cigbage that I mentioned way at the beginning, the vinegar stew, which resulted in the escabeche in Spain. And then, of course, we have in the New World, we have the ceviche. Now, of course, they're not identical, but the idea of the, as you say, vinegar fish and so on. And incidentally, cigbage was also often eaten cold.
There you go.
Yeah, so there's a link. Although one of my favorite links has to be that, and there is some resistance, I have to say, but I'm a firm believer that the British national dish, fish and chips,
right,
actually has Arab roots. Obviously not the chips.
yeah. By the fish.
But the fish, the fried fish, because the fried fish, as I say, I'm perhaps at risk of blaspheming in the eyes of some people. But if we go back to the fried fish, which essentially was imported, popularized in this country by Jewish immigrants.
Mm.
And it can be traced back, actually, to inhabitants of the Iberian Peninsula.
Yeah.
And so it's not really that big of a leap of the imagination to say, okay, and actually, in one of the cookery books, there is a recipe for fried fish, which I've recreated. And it is essentially, it doesn't use the kind of batter that we use now, but it is very clearly and identifiably a relative of the present day fish or fish preparation as it occurs in fish and chips. So, yeah, there you have it.
mm-hmm. Which reminds me, I think I saw on your Instagram once, you had a recipe about a fish, like one piece of fish, one whole fish, but cooked three different ways?
Yes. Well, that's talk about the unusual techniques that they used. Yes, the fish cooked three ways. That's a very wowable example.
yeah.
But okay, so this is how. So it's cooking fish, one fish, in three different ways simultaneously. That's the principle.
Yeah.
The head is roasted. The center is poached, and the tail is fried. But you know, there's more to it. Mm-hmm. So they also stuff the fish with a filling of fish. That's another fun thing. You know, they were such pranksters. They would stuff a chicken with chicken, or stuff a rabbit with rabbit. And then sometimes they would hollow out an animal and then make a filling with its meat and that of another animal and stuff it back in and reconstruct it. Wonderful, right. Wonderful. But let's return to our fish cooked three ways. So there's a stuffing of fish and also eggs and of course spices. You know, the more, this is not a less is more cuisine. More
is more.
So we have all kinds of wonderful flavors going on there. So we have spikenard, slightly bitter. We've got cloves, we've got ginger, cumin, coriander, of course. And then also some citron leaves, apple peel that are also added. And so what they did, you put the on an oven dish. And so there's a thick cloth which is soaked in water. That's wrapped around the center of the fish.
Of course.
To poach it.
Yeah.
Okay. The lower part is bandaged also, but that one, of course, is soaked in oil, thus frying it. And so when you take it out, it has very distinct flavors. And of course, you're also supposed to have different sauces for each part of the fish, which there are, of course, also recipes. But this fish cooked three ways has a bit of a sting in the tail. Sorry, pun intended. I couldn't resist. In its fried tail, there's a sting. in that, incredibly, a very similar recipe is found in a famous French cookery manual from the 15th century, the so-called Vivandier, which also has this fish cooked in different ways simultaneously.
Right. Okay.
What is the connection? I don't know. But it is interesting nonetheless. And of course, I'm tempted to say that at some point this recipe traveled up north and somebody decided to recreate this visual extravaganza.
Yeah, I'm sure it has. I'm sure it has. When is the recipe that you're mentioning, the Arab recipe? What century is it from?
That's from El Warraq's book. Okay, so the one from the 10th century. Yeah, so it's a very old one. Yeah.
So it's about 400 or 500 years difference.
Yeah, correct. The French ones. Correct.
Clearly they copied.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Problem solved. Yeah. What's your favorite thing to cook?
That's a tricky one.
Okay.
Perhaps what's my favorite one to eat is...
what's your favorite one to eat?
To eat one that I have a soft spot for is a wonderful dish, which unfortunately is one of those that has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called a judaba.
Right.
Originally a Persian dish. And it's one of the dishes that was made in the tanur. Wasn't made in the brick oven, but in the tanur. And the principle is very simple. It's what in English we call a drip pudding. Mm. And so imagine the following. You have a pan. They use a special pan. That was another thing. The kitchenware was just astounding. They had all manner of sophisticated things. They had graters, different types of knives, and so on and so forth. But so here they have a special pan. And in that pan, you have flatbreads. And so you layer flatbreads, and in between them, you have fruit. My favorite is banana. Incidentally, bananas used very, very rarely in the recipes. But anyway.
But they were used. Wow, okay.
You can use any fruit, really, whatever you like. You can, I guess, would work great with apple too. Mm. And so you layer it, and then there's a layer of alternating layers of fruit and flatbread.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, so this goes in the tanur, and then above it, there is a chicken that is roasting, and so the juices of the chicken then essentially also drop into this. What becomes a bread pudding.
Yeah.
And so you serve the bread pudding, if you like, with the chicken, with pieces of chicken on top. And the interesting thing is that, and I know this may appear to be a problem for those of us who don't eat meat, you would imagine a bread pudding with fruit and then meat. Actually, the bread pudding does not have a meaty flavor at all.
Right.
It's a very, very interesting dish and truly delicious. Other than that, I also am very, very partial to, you mentioned it, the pomegranate stews, pomegranate chicken.
Mm.
And the third kind of group of dishes is with mustard. They had some very nice mustard dishes, that chicken with mustard, for instance, with mustard sauce, which I also think is quite delicious. To tell you the truth, there have been very few, if any, real disasters. There's only one really that comes to mind that was inedible.
Yeah.
And that was, how to describe this? I think the best way to describe it is, think of a baklava with meat.
Yeah. Right.
And it tastes as revolting as it sounds. So but other than that, they've all really, and as you've pointed out already, they knew what they were doing. They were such proficient and competent cooks. Everything comes together. And even where you think, oh my goodness, these flavors, that won't work. Once you taste it, it just all comes together. And it is quite, I think, quite the achievement that after so many centuries, people today can still enjoy what the chefs created.
Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, I want to ask you about that 10th book you said we didn't know about and you found out. Which one was that?
I finished the edition, so the transcription of the manuscript and the translation. So this is an interesting one. It's once again an anonymous one, so there's no authorship.
Yeah.
And there's also no date. It's part of a collection that also has some medical text in the volume, and mm-hmm. it has very interesting features. The main interesting feature is that the recipes are those of the oldest tradition. Because you remember I mentioned that as time went on, certain dishes were no longer cooked, or at least were no longer included in the recipe books.
Yeah.
Here, the recipes have more in common with the earliest tradition, say, El-Waraq, than they do with the later tradition, say, the Solstice Feast, to take those at kind of opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So that would mean that this is a very early text. The other interesting thing about it is that it contains a lot of medical information, which also brings it closer to the El-Waraq tradition, if you will, which, of course, also contains information, dietary information, so on, about ingredients, recipes, and so on. So that's another piece of circumstantial evidence to place it at the very beginning. The third and final highly interesting aspect of the work is that the manuscript copy in question was clearly produced in the Muslim West, because the script is the North African script.
Right.
And so, as I said, there's no indication as to when the copy was produced or by whom, but it again supports this exchange and movement of dishes, ingredients across the entire Mediterranean. But so that's a very, very exciting, project.
And you don't mind telling us, how did you find that out?
By accident.
Those are great things.
yes, indeed so. But by accident, by going through the manuscript. And of course, often the description was merely of foodstuffs, so ingredients, categories of foodstuffs, which often means that it's just pharmacological information.
Yeah.
There may be references to dishes, but like there are references to dishes in the work of Ibn Sina, you know, Avicenna, and so on, but no real recipes. And so as I went through the manuscript, I found that the bigger part, the bulk of it, is our recipes, food recipes, just like those of the other cookery books.
Yeah. And of course, that wasn't translated, and you're doing the translation now, or you finished?
Great. Yes.
And this is something that's going to be published in some place?
Yes, I'm hoping that will be published early next year.
Yeah, brilliant. For the general public, or is it going to be like academic work?
Well, it's also going to be a bilingual Arabic-English edition. But I hope that it's something that will be interesting for everybody, to be honest.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to it, actually. Yeah, definitely. Right, what can I say? I mean, that was fantastic. I can have you here all night and talk about medieval Arab cuisine, but I think you probably have other things to do. That was brilliant. Thank you so much for joining on the podcast. And if you want people, to follow you on Instagram, for example,
yes, absolutely. That's medieval Arab cooking.
Great. And anything else?
The blog is eatlikeasultan.com.
I love it. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, thank you so much. I hope we'll keep in touch and talk soon.
Okay, no, thank you. It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure, Thomas. And hopefully, one day I'll get an invite to one of your
My little fists.
Yes.
Have a lovely evening and a brilliant Easter weekend, and talk to you soon.
Okay. Same to you, Thomas. Same to you. It was great fun. Thank you for having me, and all the best, and hope we meet in the not too distant future.
Indeed. Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye. You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you once again for listening to the Delicious Legacy podcast. I love to hear your thoughts and responses, so please head over on Twitter and tell me what you think. You can follow the podcast at The Delicious Legacy, all one word. Or join me on Patreon, where you can put The Delicious Legacy again, one word. And that's Patreon, Patreon.com/ The Delicious Legacy. Or Google Patreon and The Delicious Legacy podcast. This podcast can only keep going with the generous support of our subscribers on Patreon. You guys keep me running, you help me cover my costs, and allow me to dedicate more time researching each episode. I want to thank all of my subscribers for helping so far to create this series. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider going to Patreon and type The Delicious Legacy podcast and contribute something and keep this podcast running. Thanks for listening. All the best. Over and out.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.